Joe and I were British, but lived in Spain.
You're not working in Spain?
No, we were supposed to be retired.
You do nothing?
Well, I wrote books.
What the name of your book?
Chickens, Mules,
Chicken. You write about chicken and mule. What is mule?
I tried to explain, then fired questions at her. Are all the classrooms so small?
Oh, yes, on this floor all small, except for the Arabic geography teacher. She has a big, big room and a bed. Sometimes she lock room to take a nap.
She clapped her hands and giggled.
You see? You see?
But there's no space in here.
No space, yes. Every year the same thing.
And where are the books? No paper. No exercise books.
The students, they buy all that. Not at first. You need to nag them. Then they buy later.
And what about our timetables? The schedule? Hawa shrugged.
Schedule not ready.
Poor Hawa answered my onslaught of questions as best she could. My heart sank with each reply. This was not what I'd expected at all. How can we prepare our lessons with no books and no schedule? Hawa shrugged again, so I tried a different tack. What are the kids like?
Some very good, some very bad. Most very, very lazy.
You see, you see. How good is their English?
Most is okay. You see.
What is the middle school principal like? But Musawad didn't get the chance to respond. Raised voices from the room next door made us both stop and listen.
That Mr. Brewster,
she whispered.
With Tao. He the computer guy. They try to fix the schedule. I don't know who the lady voice is.
I do. That's Miss Darina, the high school principal. Just then my mobile phone rang. It was Joe.
How are you getting on? I can't find a staff room that isn't full of people, but I've met a teacher called Rashida, and she's shown me a place where we can sit outside in the shade. I'll meet you at the main door, okay?
The argument next door was getting more heated, although I couldn't make out any actual words. Hawa excused herself and slipped into her own classroom. I shut the door on my own dismal little classroom and went down the corridor to meet Joe. We crossed the courtyard together, the sun blinding us and making us squint. The heat was unbearable.
"It's here,"
he said, rounding the corner behind one of the administration blocks and pushing a gate open. We walked down a narrow alley, flanked by the school perimeter wall on one side and the classroom block on the other. Around two corners, the alley opened out a little, and I saw two rows of old chairs facing each other. Someone had constructed a temporary roof that provided much-needed shade.
"This is Smoker's Corner," said Joe. "Rashida told me it's for staff to use if they want. Imagine providing a smoking area for teachers. You wouldn't get that in the UK. Anyway, it's a private area for all staff, whether they smoke or not."
"So who is Rashida?"
I asked.
"I think she teaches algebra in the high school. She's Lebanese and has worked here for years. She borrowed my pen. Actually, I don't think she gave it back."
Joe and I were just comparing observations when Joe's phone rang. It was Colton, telling us that Jazim and the school bus were waiting to take us to the bank. ASS insisted we open bank accounts for the payment of our salaries. The bank was cool, modern, and airy. We had to wait a long time, as accounts needed to be opened for each new teacher. It was the turn of a fellow teacher, Barry. Older than most, he was talking incessantly to the bank teller. Barry, who sported huge yellow teeth and wafted bad breath as he spoke, never stopped talking.
"I'm just a dude,"
said Barry, leaning in to the poor bank teller, who recoiled from the blast of toxic odour directed at her.
"I'm just a dude from the good old US of A, here to instruct kids in your country. Before I came here, I was..."
"Get on with it," muttered Joe.
But Barry was in full swing, and unlikely to be stopped easily.
"And then, of course, before Saudi, I..."
"Oh, for heaven's sake,"
said Joe through clenched teeth, scratching himself down below.
I'm just a dude, but I always think,
Barry droned on. And on. Joe's impatience rose in a crescendo, and he pushed his way out through the bank's entrance doors to cool his temper with a breath of fresh air, quickly returning when he discovered there wasn't any outside.
Get on with it,
repeated Joe, in a voice loud enough for Barry to hear. It had the desired effect. Barry signed the last paper and vacated his seat. Joe and I were next, and were soon clutching our new bank account number. As we waited for the last few, I noticed most of the bank staff's name tags read Khalifa.
That means they're related to the king,
whispered Jake.
I don't know if it's true, but somebody told me that the king gives all the best jobs to his friends and relations.
Back at the hotel, we felt exhausted and settled down to take a nap. I was just dozing off when the telephone rang.
Hi, Jake here. Fancy coming down to our room? We've got some beer and wine and a few people here. Come and join us.
Tell him we'll be there in an hour,
said Joe, half asleep.
Jake, we'll be there in an hour.
Aw, can't you come now?
Reluctantly, we got up, splashed warm water, cold tap water doesn't exist in August, on our faces, and knocked on Jake's door. The apartment was filled with other new teachers, who all stopped talking and spun round to look at us as we entered.
Sorry about that, said Joe to the room. It's not often I get a chance for a spot of afternoon hanky-panky with Vicky. We were just getting into it when Jake called.
My jaw dropped with horror and embarrassment.
But we weren't doing anything,
I squeaked. Everybody was silent, staring at us, probably imagining us oldsters in the throes of passion and not enjoying the image. Only Jake and Colton roared with laughter. They already understood Joe's warped sense of humour. Later, whenever they got the chance, they would harmonise afternoon delight in our hearing, much to my chagrin and Joe's amusement. Actually, they both had excellent voices, but the song always made me wince. In spite of Joe's bad behaviour, we had a good time and stayed late, after most of the other guests had left. There were six of us, and we were to spend a lot of time together in the future. There was Jake and his beautiful girlfriend, Emily. Emily held a British passport, but had been raised in America, and no traces of an English accent remained. She would teach in the elementary school. She had made friends with another elementary teacher, Allison, a lovely redhead from Iowa. Then there was Colton, and finally Joe and me. We sat round the big polished table in Jake and Emily's suite and laughed the night away. It felt like a scene from Friends, except that Joe and I were so much older.
So, I said after a few glasses of wine, who knows why the three fat ladies hate Miss Arena? They've hardly met her.
I think I know,
said Jake, who always seemed to know everything that was going on.
I think Dr. Cecily was expecting to be given the job of high school principal, and they used to have a really easy time with the last principal, so I think Miss Darina's arrival has really ruffled their collective feathers.
This confirmed what I had suspected, and filled in a few more gaps.
And what do you think of Barry?
Everyone groaned.
Halle Berry.
It was an apt name, the halitosis being Barry's chief trait. Nobody remembered exactly where in the States he hailed from, but during the previous year he had been teaching in Saudi Arabia. Apparently he had left under mysterious circumstances that were never properly explained.
Hey, I'm just a dude,
said Jake, imitating Barry perfectly, hands shoulder height, palms exposed, exactly as Barry often did.
He's creepy, said Emily. Yes, he stares at you, then corners you and tells her his life history, said Allison. And all the time he's talking, he's kind of undressing you with his eyes.
Hey, he'll be a member of your faculty,
Colton happily pointed out to Joe.
He teaches math, doesn't he?
Joe shuddered.
And what do you think of Brent?
He asked. We all agreed that Brent was very peculiar. All of us had spelled our names for his notebook several times.
Well, school starts on Tuesday. I wonder how many kids will turn up, someone asked.
I tried to imagine myself teaching a class of Arabic kids, with no schedule, no books, no paper, in a classroom the size of a cupboard, but failed miserably. Back in our room, a scribbled note had been pushed under our door. "Vicky, I've found something out. Come over for a coffee when you can. D." I looked at my watch. It was too late now, but I was very curious to hear what Darina had discovered. Chapter 6 The Worm. Early the next morning, I tapped on Darina's door. She appeared in a pink fluffy bathrobe and tugged me inside. I shivered. Darina always kept her air conditioning set at very cold. "I guess I like it that way because I'm from Canada," she said, "and your room temperature is like Spain." "So what did that note mean?" I asked when she'd made coffee. "What did you find out?" "The schedule. You know the schedules aren't ready."
"Of course. Everybody's talking about it."
"What's the problem?"
"A worm."
"A worm is the problem." I looked at her blankly. "A worm?"
"The reason the schedule is not ready is because the staff member who was in charge of timetabling last year didn't get his contract renewed."
"So?"
"So he infected the system with a worm, a virus or something, and he's the only one who knows the password to the school setup. He's left the island, and the school can't fix the program."
"Oh, my. That's illegal, isn't it?"
"Oh, yes. It's all being kept hush-hush because it would reflect badly on the school. We don't want the parents or the students to know about it. Mrs. Sherazy made him a promise that she wouldn't call the police if he handed over the password."
"So has he agreed?"
"No, he has not. This is one very disgruntled ex-employee."
"So what's going to happen?"
"Mrs. Sherazy is going to offer him money to come back and fix it. Miss Naima from the office is going to meet him secretly somewhere. I'm assuming he's agreed to come back to the island. We'll just have to wait and see. All the students are arriving on Tuesday expecting their schedules, and the teachers can't function without theirs. I've been closeted in the central computer room with Datu and Mr. Brewster, trying to get our heads round the problem."
"Yes, my classroom is next door, I heard you."
"Mr. Brewster is being a bit obstructive. I gather he fell out with the last principal, so he's probably suspicious of me. He's supposed to be a bit of an expert with computers. The middle school is going to be easier to sort because it's much smaller than the high school. We have a real problem on our hands with the high school."
We chatted on. I asked Darina whether she was pleased with her staff so far. Had she met them all? What were her first impressions? It was then that I learned, nice as she was, Darina was not the best judge of character.
"Oh, I have two favourites already," she said happily. "That Mas Berry, I think he's going to be an asset to the school, and he's such a gentleman, so attentive. And Brant, a very intelligent young man, with credentials as long as your arm."
Darina had a way of accompanying her words with actions, like a kindergarten teacher. "As long as your arm" was illustrated by shooting out one arm, to emphasize just how very long Brent's credentials were. Unfortunately, she knocked over the table lamp and spilled her coffee in the process. I had news for her, too. I explained why she wasn't popular with the three fat ladies, which bothered her not at all. Darina was one of those people who never bears a grudge. Dare I say, a rare quality for us women. I'm ashamed to confess I've been known to harbour a grudge for years, until I can't even remember why I disliked that person in the first place. The few days before school started flashed past in a haze of heat and activity. Every morning we waited in the hotel lobby, shadowed by Toothy the porter, who bowed and scraped, offering to carry our school bags, hoping for a tip. Jasmine was usually late, but nobody ever complained, probably for three very good reasons. First, Jasmine was popular. Everybody liked him. He reminded me of the genie in Aladdin, because they shared the same broad, friendly, grinning face. Second, Jasmine had a dark side. His driving style reflected his mood, and a journey with an unhappy Jassim was not an experience anybody, except Joe, enjoyed. And third, nobody would be foolish enough to argue with Jassim, who was built like a brick outhouse. Like the genie in Aladdin, he had huge forearms, and stood with his arms folded. When not driving the bus, he would join the security team at the school gates, his powerful muscles rippling under his uniform. Each drive with Jassim was an adventure. Every morning we greeted him and clambered onto the school bus for the first of our twice-daily fairground rides. Jassim would accelerate away, tyres screeching and sending up plumes of sand that obscured a bowing and waving Toothy. Few journeys on the school bus were uneventful. For instance, Jassim had two mobile phones that often rang simultaneously. As his passengers held their breaths, Jassim would clamp a phone to each ear and fire off a stream of Arabic, while steering with his elbows. He regularly drove at oncoming traffic, ignoring their flashing headlights and horns, at the last moment suddenly diving down a side street. Traffic lights meant nothing to him, stopping only if obstructed by other vehicles. Joe, smiling broadly at the conclusion of each journey, would shake his head and say, "That was awesome, Jassim. Thank you." The rest of us would emerge trembling. During those days without students, we familiarised ourselves with the school, and I prepared my classroom. Joe, of course, was a floater, with no classroom of his own, so he had little to do except chat with other members of staff. Having no schedule, he had no idea what classes he would be teaching, and therefore was unable to prepare for them. Once home again, we waited for nightfall when the shops would open, then purchased teacher stuff, cardboard, red pens, files and folders. I bought coloured gift-wrapping paper and, as Hawa had advised, pasted it on the windows of my classroom, blocking out the view of the courtyard. I would also have bought a fish and fish bowl, if I'd had enough space in my classroom. Tuesday loomed, the first day of school, and still we had no schedule. The veteran teachers, led by the ever-resentful three fat ladies, blamed Darina. Even the new staff blamed Darina, having listened to the three fat ladies. Only a few knew the truth, but we weren't permitted to discuss it. The villainous worm hadn't kept his assignation, and the computer program was infected beyond repair. Darina, Mr. Brewster, and the administration staff were attempting to assemble the schedule manually. The task was enormous and hugely complicated. Suddenly, it was Tuesday morning, the first day of the new school year. We rose at 5:30 a.m., as we would every school day in the future. I couldn't eat any breakfast, partly due to the early hour, but mostly because of my nervousness. Being Ramadan, it was our last chance to eat something until late in the afternoon when we returned from school. My stomach churned, and the toast Joe made me tasted like sawdust. I couldn't swallow. Even Joe was unusually quiet. Jassim was late. By the time we arrived at ASS, the street outside was filled with parked cars disgorging students. I gaped. Many of the cars were chauffeur-driven, and all were glittering expensive vehicles. Mercedes, Range Rovers, Ferraris, Rolls-Royces. Not a camel inside. Jassim somehow barged his way through the shiny cars and dropped us off at the front gates. The courtyard was thronging with students of all shapes and sizes. Tall young men shouted and called across the yard to each other. Pretty, veiled teenage girls stood in huddles, whispering and giggling behind their hands, or texting on their iPhones and Blackberries. Younger students kicked empty Coke cans, rough and tumbled, or chased one another. Nobody seemed to be in charge, and everything appeared disorderly. We fought our way to the clocking-in machine and punched our cards for the first time. It was 7:15 a.m., and the machine was unforgiving. Because it was after 7 a.m, it stamped the time in red. Three red lates meant we would be deducted a day's salary. Not a good start. We all headed for the classroom block, the students staring curiously, standing back, creating a path like the parting of the Red Sea.
Brent strode ahead, alone. Halle Barry was talking loudly to Andrea and her beautiful roommate, Sadra. Neither appeared remotely interested. "Good luck," I whispered to Joe.
"Good luck," he answered,
and we pushed through the swing doors into the school building. The first thing I noticed was a chair occupied by an Indian lady in a sari in the corridor.
"Welcome to your first proper day at ASS,"
said a voice at my elbow. It was Hawa, dressed in sky blue, her veil decorated with tiny feathers and butterflies.
"Who is the lady in the chair in the corridor?"
I asked, unlocking my classroom.
"That is her monitor,"
explained Hawa, her brown eyes twinkling.
"She keep order in the corridor."
She clapped her hands.
"You see soon."
My classroom was dark and stiflingly hot. I switched on the lights and air conditioning. I checked that the desks were lined up in neat rows and sighed deeply. "Bring it on," I thought. I was as ready as I ever would be. Then the bell rang, and a huge roar of youthful voices rose from the courtyard. I heard the students stampede to the entrance doors, shouting, pushing, jostling. I braced myself.
"Out! Out! All middle school students go back out to the courtyard!"
bellowed a voice that I recognised as belonging to Mr. Brewster, the middle school principal.
"Ah!"
yelled the kids, but obediently spilled back outside. The lower part of my classroom windows were papered over, so I needed to stand on a chair to see what was happening outside. With difficulty, Mr. Brewster and his deputy divided the students into groups of 20.
"Group number one,"
roared Mr. Brewster.
"Group number one go to math with Miss Hawa."
Group number one picked up their school bags and headed for the doors.
"Group number two, go to English with Miss Vicky."
I hurriedly jumped off the chair and stood by the classroom door, ready to welcome them, and was almost bowled over by the mob of children intent on reaching the best seats, those in the back row. Chairs overturned, and small fights broke out. I waited until each student was seated, aware that first impressions are all important. At last they settled, eyeing me suspiciously. "Look at my classroom," I said. "I expect you to come into my room quietly, not knocking over desks, not charging in like a herd of wildebeest." Some kids pulled faces at each other, others fell silent, others grumbled.
"What is a wildebeest?"
asked a cheeky-looking boy. "It's an African wild animal," I said shortly.
"Meat good as animals," said a moon-faced boy, eyes wide.
I sensed I'd already made a faux pas, but blundered on. "Now, I want you all to stand up and go quietly out into the corridor, then come back in again sensibly. This time, I want you to sort yourselves out into alternate rows of boys and girls."
"Miss, what we do, miss?" "I'm not sitting next to a boy," exclaimed a girl wearing a hijab. "Sit next to a girl?" asked the cheeky boy. "Not me."
Things were not going at all well, but I knew I had to follow through.
"Into the corridor, all of you," I repeated. "Oh, miss," complained the class.
But they did as they were told, much to my relief.
"You, all you, go back in classroom," shrilled a voice outside.
It was the hall monitor.
"You're not allowed in hall in lesson time." "But the miss told us to come out."
"It's okay," I explained to the hall monitor. "I sent them out. Now, class, go back in.
And quietly."
From the corner of my eye, I saw a black-robed, shadowy figure watching the whole scene. Somehow I sensed this lady was no idle spectator. This lady was going to feature in my future. Chapter 7. Giving Up. The class filed back in, a little more orderly this time, with no chairs knocked over, although I noticed the moon-faced boy attempting to trip the girl in the hijab. It was only when they were seated once more that I saw a flaw in my plan to separate them,
More than three-quarters of the class were boys. I gave up with the seating plan.
"Good morning, everybody," I began, standing at the front in the only tiny space available in the room. Thanks to the worm, I had no class list, so I had to improvise. "My name is Miss Vicky. Please call me Miss Vicky, not Miss, and I shall attempt to take your names, one by one." I turned to the cheeky boy, who was now sitting in the front row. "What is your name?"
"Miss, my name is Mohammed, Miss."
I wrote it down and looked at the next boy. "Name, please?"
"Mohammed, Miss."
Two Mohammeds in this class. "And you?" I asked a third boy.
"Miss, Mohammed, Miss."
This was getting ridiculous. Three Mohammeds. "Okay," I said, "how many Mohammeds do we have in this room?" A forest of hands were raised. I should have asked who wasn't called Mohammed. I tried asking for their second names, but the strange words and spellings just confused me further. The children were becoming bored and fidgety. I gave up with the class list.
"Miss, where are our schedules, Miss?"
asked the cheeky boy.
"Where do we go next lesson?"
They're just being finished," I said. "You'll be getting them soon. And please call me Miss Vicky, not Miss."
"Sorry, Miss." "Miss, what do you want us to do, Miss?"
I sighed and gave up with the Miss. "Right," I said brightly. "I'm going to tell you four things about myself, and then I want each of you to tell me four things about yourselves. Okay?"
"Yes, Miss."
"Number one. My name is Miss Vicky, and this is my first year at ASS."
"Where all students succeed,"
shouted the class, making me jump. "Number two, my husband teaches physics and maths in the high school."
"Miss, does he, Miss? He might teach my brother,"
said a girl. "Oh, really? What's your brother's name?"
Silly question.
"Mohammed, Miss."
"Number three, I'm British, but I live in a little village in Spain."
"Miss, Spain won the World Cup, Miss."
"Yes, I know. I was there at the time."
"Miss, which football team do you support, Miss?"
I opened my mouth to answer, but the class had dissolved into a shouting match, each boy yelling out the team he supported and leaning over to punch any boy within range who didn't agree.
"Miss, Liverpool is the greatest. Miss, Miss, Manchester United. No, Miss, Arsenal. Miss, Chelsea."
It seemed that Arabic kids knew more about English football than I did. I was just trying to regain order when a pale face appeared briefly at the little window in my classroom door. It was female, black-veiled, and I guessed belonged to the shadowy figure I had seen earlier in the corridor. Who was she?
"Number four, my hobbies are reading and writing, and I love animals."
Hoots of derision from the class.
"Miss, reading and writing is boring, Miss."
"Miss, why you like animals, Miss? Animals are dirty."
"Animals are ugly, Miss."
I gaped at them. Perhaps I hadn't heard right. "Don't you have pets?" I asked.
"No, Miss."
"Not even camels?"
"No, Miss." "My father and my uncle have falcons, Miss, but they're not pets."
I gave up on animals. In desperation, I hit on a surefire subject, one that I knew was of interest, one that my pupils in England adored talking about. "What is your favourite food?" I asked.
"Miss,"
said a sweet-faced girl patiently,
"it's Ramadan. We don't talk about food in Ramadan."
Again, I gave up. Enough class discussion. I would quieten them down by getting them to write.
"Okay, I want you to get out paper and pens. Write your name at the top of the paper, then write four good sentences about yourselves."
"Miss, we didn't bring paper and pens today."
"Why not?"
"We never do anything on the first day of term. Not many kids come to school because of Ramadan."
Mentally, I threw in the towel yet again. Luckily, the bell rang, and my charges departed, only to be replaced by another batch of rowdy Mohammeds. I fervently hoped that Joe was faring better.
After nearly 4 hours of solid teaching, without so much as a sip of water, I closed the classroom door behind the last Mohammed. My voice, unaccustomed to such heavy usage, had deteriorated into a rasping croak. I had an hour before my next lesson, valuable time to prepare for tomorrow. Then I had to attend a meeting, where all the grade 6 teachers would meet each other. Finally, back to the hotel. I sighed and tried not to think of our home in the village of Eloyo, where the only people I met were villagers, where I could eat and drink what I pleased, and nobody was called Mohammed. I was just straightening the desks when somebody tapped on the door.
"Come in,"
I rasped. The door opened, and a black-robed figure swept in. I recognized it immediately. It was the shadowy figure I had seen in the corridor when I had sent my first class out. I examined her face, and was certain that it was the same face I had seen peering into my classroom.
"Can I help?" I asked. "Miss Vicky, I am Fatima's mother." "Oh, hello, I'm very pleased to meet you."
I smiled and offered my hand, but quickly dropped it when she made no move to reciprocate. Her hands remained hidden in the flowing folds of her abaya. This lady had a pale, waxy complexion, her face framed by a black hijab. Her narrow, colourless eyes drilled into mine. Her voice was accented, but she spoke English well. "I'm so sorry," I began. "I'm not sure which one is your daughter. I met 3 classes for the first time today."
"Fatima was in your first class. She is an exceptional student."
The pale eyelids twitched.
"Well, I look forward to getting to know her," I said. "But the class lists haven't been finalized yet. Mr. Wayne may be teaching her, not me."
"No, I have spoken with the school's owner, Mrs. Sherazi, and also Mr. Brewster. They have both promised me that you will be teaching Fatima."
"Oh. Was this a compliment?" I wasn't quite sure, but I felt most uncomfortable.
"Fatima's education is extremely important, and English, in my opinion, is the most important subject."
Yes, English is very important."
"So I came here to introduce myself and to let you know that you have my full support in giving Fatima the best education possible."
Thank you."
"One more thing,"
she said, her cold eyes boring into me.
"Please do not call my daughter a wildebeest ever again."
She bowed briefly and swept out of the room, not allowing me to explain that I hadn't exactly called her daughter a wildebeest. The words Fatima's mother had uttered weren't threatening, but I was left with a distinct impression that I was being warned. I shook my head to clear it. I didn't have the time to worry about a parent just now. Somehow I got through the last class and headed to the geography room for the meeting. The Arabic teacher sat in her upholstered teacher chair, her hands folded in her lap, while the rest of us sat at the students' desks.
"You meet Fatima's mother already?"
whispered Hawa, rolling her eyes.
"Yes." I wasn't sure what to make of her.
"That woman! Everybody has heard of that woman!"
All the little butterflies pinned to her hijab trembled in sympathy as she spoke.
"That woman! She make life miserable for all the teachers in the elementary school last year. Me, I nor let her bully me."
I believed her. The clenched fists and grim look of determination didn't fit with the delicate, exotic butterflies dancing around her head, but I sensed a huge inner strength and began to understand why she described herself as the meanest teacher. Mr. Brewster entered at that point, and the meeting began. All the grade 6 teachers were present, and we introduced ourselves to each other. I already knew Hawa, and had shaken hands with the Arabic geography teacher. I also knew young Mohammed, the science teacher, who was a quiet, gentle, bespectacled young man from Lebanon. He rarely spoke, and telephoned his father every evening. Like many of the new staff, this was his first teaching job, and the first time he had left his own country. I knew he was sharing a hotel suite with Brent, the strange talk teacher, and wondered how compatible they were.
My eyes searched the room. It was Mr. Wayne that interested me most, because he was the only other grade six English teacher. I assumed we would be working as a team.
"The only person missing is Mr. Wayne,"
said Mr. Brewster, looking around.
"Ah, here he is."
Wayne's athletic outline filled the doorway. Very tall, he was an African-American, like Mr. Brewster. He was 30-something, with the physique of a weightlifter. But it wasn't his bulk that was remarkable. It was the multicoloured clothes he wore. It started from his feet, encased in yellow patent leather shoes with black stitching, went up to faded jeans with designer slashes, continued with a purple shirt under an orange cardigan, and was topped off by a lime-green felt hat. His style definitely made a statement, although I wasn't sure what statement it made. So this was the other member of my team.
"Cool,"
breathed Wayne.
"Wayne, welcome,"
said Mr. Brewster, clapping him affectionately on the back.
"Take a seat. We've heard a lot about you. Welcome to ASS.
"Where all students succeed,"
chanted the other teachers without much enthusiasm. Mr. Brewster waxed lyrical, describing Wayne's many talents, as described by his former employer. I listened carefully, but it seemed that Wayne hadn't actually been a schoolteacher before. Oh, well, it had been a long time since I'd been in a classroom too, so probably we were on the same level.
"Mr. Brewster, he don't like women very much,"
whispered Hawar from behind her hand.
"I've been here many, many year, and he no listen to women. He only make best friend with the men. You see."
"Is Mr. Brewster married?" I asked from the corner of my mouth.
"Yes. He chose a wife last year from village in Thailand."
That surprised me. The meeting wound up, and I tried to chat with my team member before I caught the bus, but didn't make much headway. Wayne was leaning back in his chair, long legs stretched out, chin resting on his chest, absorbed with texting on his mobile. I stepped over his legs and sat in the vacant chair beside him. "Hi, we should have a chat about what books and stuff we're doing this year," I said.
"Cool,"
he purred, but didn't look up. For the 100th time that day, I gave up and made my way back to the waiting school bus via the clocking-in machine. I caught sight of Fatima's mother hovering around the admin block and gave her a brief smile, which wasn't returned. It had been a very long day, and it hadn't finished yet. Chapter 8. Adjusting. Joe was already on the bus, looking haggard. I slipped into the seat beside him. The bus was unusually quiet, all the teachers looking exhausted and more than a little shell-shocked. Jazim started the engine and drew away from the school, homeward bound. A few blocks from the school, some roadworks were underway. Indian workers were paving the sidewalk with red bricks, and a no-entry rope was stretched across the road. Jazim ignored it, driving through and snapping the barrier as the workers leapt aside in alarm. "How was your day?" I asked Joe at last.
"Diabolical."
"Oh, dear. Why?"
"Well, the schedule isn't finished yet, so I was given a class to look after. About 20 of them. None had any books or paper or anything."
"Ah, that's exactly what happened to me."
"Mr. Rena said that we were supposed to start teaching right away. But the students I was given were all different ages, ranging from 14 to 19. Only two of them were doing physics."
"So what did you do?"
"Well, first I had a chat with them. Then some got out their Blackberries and sent texts to their friends. Some just sat around playing cards or listening to music on their iPods. I just let them get on with it. Luckily I had my Ibsen plays with me, so I sat and read."
"So what was the problem?"
"Well, you know how immersed I get when I'm reading."
"Yes."
"I didn't notice the class go all quiet. Miss Darina must have been passing and heard the noise. Anyway, she came in and bawled at them. She said playing cards wasn't allowed and they weren't supposed to have iPods or Blackberries in the classroom. She said I should be teaching them. But how could I?"
"Did the kids behave after that?"
"As if," Joe snorted. He scratched his nethers. "Some of them escaped. I don't know where they went. The rest just carried on playing cards and stuff."
"And the rest of the day?"
"All the same. The students just wandered around doing whatever they liked. Sometimes, when some escaped, the hall monitors brought them back, but they soon slipped out again. Mr. Rena came back in once, and I didn't even notice. She confiscated their playing cards and stuck them right under my nose. Gave me a shock, because I was so immersed in Ibsen."
I laughed. "Well, let's look on the internet tonight. We should be able to find some general knowledge quizzes or something to occupy them tomorrow."
"The whole thing is just chaos," said Joe, giving himself another hearty scratch. "You can't run a school without a timetable. I honestly don't know if I'm going to last the course. The thought of the months ahead makes me want to book the next flight back to Spain."
Judging by the snippets of other conversations on the bus, everybody had had a bad day. And they all blamed one person for the absence of a schedule, the principal, Mr. Rena. I'd been sworn to secrecy about the evil worm, so I couldn't defend her.
"This wasn't what I was expecting at all," Joe grumbled, and lapsed into silence.
I knew what he was thinking about, and so was I. I pictured our garden in Spain, swallows swooping and wheeling in the sky, cicadas chirruping busily in our grapevine. Village cats with their new litters of kittens would be hiding from the heat, coming out to play and hunt in the cool of the evening. Our neighbours, the Ufates, dancing flamenco in the street. And we'd given all that up for this. Was it really worth it? Jasim dropped us off at the hotel, and I marched past Toothy and headed straight for Darina's room. I wanted to know if the schedule problem had been fixed. "Come in," she called when I knocked on her door. "How has your day been?" I told her the condensed version, and she sympathised. "I'm afraid the worm has gone underground," she said. "He's refusing to communicate at all now, and we're no nearer to completing a schedule. I've spent all day trying to get the teachers to teach something, anything. The students aren't stupid. They know the school isn't running properly. Did you know the last principal let them run wild? There used to be fights and stampedes in the corridor. Honestly, they were allowed to do as they pleased. I've promised Mrs. Sherrissey that I'm going to crack down. She wants me to stop the students wandering around the school, or playing cards, or listening to music when they should be learning." I didn't mention Joe's tale of woe. Secretly, I wondered how successful she would be with improving discipline in the school. Darina laughed. "Never mind," she said brightly. "I don't mind being the ogre. That's my job, and it's what I'm paid for." I certainly didn't envy her the job. "Anyway," she went on, "I didn't tell you about my shopping yesterday. I was just picking up a few things from the supermarket last night, and guess who popped up and gave me a hand?" "No idea." "That nice Barry. He carried the shopping bags all the way to my room, which was very kind of him. The trouble was, I couldn't get rid of him afterwards. He just wouldn't go." "Halle Barry." I remembered what the other female teachers had said about Halle Barry, and how they disliked his attentions. Perhaps Halle Barry was trying his luck with the principal. The worm never surfaced, and we lurched through the remainder of August and the first week of September without a schedule. My team member, the colourful Wayne, asked me for ideas to occupy our classes until a structured timetable was in place, so I shared the resources and worksheets I had created. The Gin twins had sent me a wonderful parcel of workbooks from England, exercises on punctuation, grammar and creative writing, which probably saved my sanity. I tore the staples out of the workbooks and took them up to the photocopying room, a few at a time. "Leave them there," said the grim-faced Indian who operated the giant photocopying machines. "When do you want them?"
For tomorrow, please."
The next day I went up to collect them, but was disappointed.
"Sorry, sorry," said the Indian, not looking apologetic at all. "They're not done yet."
So I ran back down the stairs, desperately thinking what tasks I could set my classes that day. This happened every day, and having anything photocopied seemed an almost impossible dream.
One hot, airless day I was sitting in Smoker's Corner, the only place where we could escape the oppressive building. I liked the regular group that congregated there. It was an assortment of male Arabic staff, Colton, Rashida, and young Mohammed from Lebanon. Even Jazim, the bus driver, would sometimes come and sit for a while. The folk there always made me laugh and helped me forget my troubles. It was also the best place to garner gossip. Some smoked, some didn't, but I always felt I was amongst friends. Joe was there, and we'd been laughing hysterically at Colton's latest tale about his hometown, Boise. The story involved the Boise River, an inflated tractor tire, and a girl with a glass eye.
"Hey, how's it going in the middle school?"
asked Colton, when we'd all stopped laughing. "Terrible," I said. "It's bad enough killing time because we can't do anything without a schedule, and I'm sick of not being able to get any photocopying done. I take my stuff up there, and he never does it. And that photocopying man is so grumpy."
"Hey, do you have some that needs doing right now?"
asked Colton.
"Give them to me."
I pulled some sheets out of my bag and handed them over. "I need 120 of those. It's a lot, I know, but I always do some for Wayne's classes, too. I don't think you'll have any luck, though. There were piles of stuff waiting to be photocopied when I went up just now." Colton just smiled and walked away. To my astonishment, he returned 10 minutes later with all my photocopying completed.
"How did you do that?"
Joe and I asked, astonished.
"Hey, it was easy," said Colton. "I just slipped him some backsheesh. One BD does the trick every time."
It had never occurred to me to tip the photocopying man. The next time I went up, I tucked a 1BD note just visible under the top sheet. It had an instant effect.
"Thank you, miss,"
he said, grinning so broadly I thought the top of his head might come off. "You wait here. I do them now." It worked like a dream, and I never had to wait for photocopying again. The photocopying man's face lit up whenever he saw me approaching, as though I was his most beloved aunt. Ramadan stretched ahead, and I often looked longingly at the padlocked canteen doors and the empty cold water dispenser in the staff room. Mr. Brewster called the occasional meeting, although there wasn't much to discuss. Until we were allocated our permanent classes, we were all merely marking time. But these meetings held another source of annoyance for me.
"I'd like to congratulate all of you for coping so well,"
said Mr. Brewster,
"particularly Wayne, who has produced all kinds of English worksheets for his classes. He is an example to us all."
Inwardly I seethed, but said nothing. Mr. Brewster also had the unfortunate habit of talking for far too long about very little, making chopping motions with his hands to emphasize each point, and constantly repeating himself. Although I liked him, I found it hard to concentrate, especially after a long day in the classroom, and without any refreshment. Worse still, he often made the middle school teachers late for Jazim's bus, and the other passengers were forced to wait until he closed our meeting. Joe and I devised a plan. Joe would call my mobile phone if we were late, and I would look up and say, "I'm sorry, the bus is waiting for us." Then Hawa and I, and all the teachers who took the bus, would stand up en masse and leave. That cured the late meetings, as well as the impatience of our fellow passengers who had been kept waiting. There were fewer regular passengers on the bus now. Jake, Colton, Emily and Allison hired a car, which they shared, and we missed their nonsense on the bus. Darina caught a separate bus, probably wisely, as conversation often centred around her latest rule enforcements. This left a hard core of passengers. The awfully strange Brent, Halle Barry, Texan Andrea, her exquisite roommate Saja, quiet young Mohammed, Hawa, Ibekwe from Ghana, Joe, myself, and sometimes a few others. Andrea was feisty and streetwise, and although she'd never taught before, was full of confidence. By contrast, her roommate, Saja, was a tiny, delicate Iraqi girl, gentle, quiet, and friendly. She had moved to America with her family when she was very young, but still understood and spoke Arabic fluently. Students were supposed only to speak English at school, but understandably reverted to their native tongue whenever possible.
Sajjah enjoyed an immense advantage over the rest of us in understanding Arabic. Her students didn't know she could understand them, and were probably horrified when they found out. Andrea's story was also interesting. She'd met and fallen for an Arab in Texas, and had applied for the job at ASS to be near him when he returned to his home in Bahrain. Her Arab boyfriend was a wealthy Sunni, who lived in a luxury compound with his extended family. We, however, felt sure there was no future in their relationship. And she probably did too. We guessed he was already betrothed to a cousin, a common Arabic practice that keeps the money in the family. We could see her boyfriend's family compound from our hotel window. However, although he lived so close, we never met him, and heard that he refused even to be seen out with her. Perhaps their cultural differences meant he shouldn't be seen with a Westerner. Instead, he visited her secretly, often very late at night. Every week we were told that our new apartments were almost ready to move into, but 6 weeks later we were still residents of the hotel. I didn't mind. Our rooms were cleaned, and the sheets and towels changed daily. In my whole life I'd never had so few chores. And no bills. Apart from food and mobile phone bills, everything was paid for. Were we grateful? Yes. But were we happy? I'm afraid not. Anyone working in a Middle Eastern country for the first time is bound to suffer from culture shock. But when you come out of retirement, and your home has been a tiny Spanish village, it's very hard. We weren't accustomed to being surrounded by so many people, as our village has only a handful of permanent residents. Although we lauded it in a hotel suite, we had no outside space apart from the rooftop pool. We missed our garden, and the ability to sit outside or stroll around the village. Being outside for long in the Bahraini summer was impossible, as the heat sapped our strength and the sun scalded our skin. But most of all, Joe and I missed the wildlife. We'd seen no animals, and no birds, except for some exhausted-looking pigeons and a few seagulls. Surprisingly, there were no flies, but there were no other insects to be seen either. Not even an ant. Jake and Emily visited the Bahraini Zoo and were astounded to see one of the exhibits, a dog in a cage, with a sign proclaiming domestic dog. Any waste ground was just an expanse of sand. No weed had the strength to survive in such dry, barren conditions. Neither did any weed dare to poke its head out from between the cracks in the red-bricked sidewalks. Colton informed us that the reason every pavement was identical was because one of the king's relations had secured the contract. We saw no trees, apart from ornamental ones carefully tended by servants. And then there were the strange customs and rules. I was terrified of making a silly mistake, like passing something using my left hand or inadvertently showing the soles of my feet. I already knew that my clothes were not really suitable. Either they were too hot, or the sleeves were too short, revealing too much arm. I promised myself, as soon as Ramadan was over, to go clothes shopping. Chapter 9. Crazy Teachers. Smoker's Corner was a sanctuary, a place to hide away from the hustle and bustle of the main school building. However, it wasn't always peaceful. The school was in the midst of several surrounding mosques, and the call to prayer regularly filled the air. In the building, the walls muffled the sound, but at Smoker's Corner it was a different story. First one, closely followed by another two, so loud that we couldn't speak until all three had finished. They were always live, never recorded, and they seemed to compete with each other. Sometimes one of the chanting elders would dissolve into a coughing fit, and Joe and I avoided looking at each other, afraid we might laugh and look disrespectful. The Arab staff who frequented Smoker's Corner were equally noisy. They loved to bawl politics at each other, or discuss English soccer. Saeed, in charge of maintenance and stationery, suffered from a serious stutter, and usually sat quietly smoking, not joining in with the conversation.
but sometimes his face would flush, his fists would ball, and one foot would begin tapping. Suddenly he would leap up and lean over Yusuf, or Essam, or Jazim, his cheeks inflated as he tried to force the words past his stutter. The first time Joe and I witnessed an argument, the red faces and clenched fists, we honestly thought they were all going to come to blows. The fights were always in Arabic and we understood nothing. It was only when we listened carefully that we realised what the topic of the argument was centred around. Saeed, Arabic, Arabic, stutter, Arabic. Yusuf, Arabic. Essam, Arabic. Saeed, Arabic.
Manchester United.
Even quiet young Mohammed, his spectacles flashing as he became animated, was drawn into these fights, which dissolved as quickly as they erupted. Saeed loved to fight physically, too, or at least demonstrate his strength. He adored Jake, but had a strange way of showing it. Whenever he encountered him, whether at Smoker's Corner or in the school corridor, his eyes would light up and he'd hold out his hand for shaking. But this was no gentle handshake. Instead, Saeed would seize Jake's hand in a vice-like grip and twist his arm behind his back. Jake played along at first, and it became a contest. Saeed never said a word, and his expression never changed, apart from a twinkle of pleasure in his eyes as he wrestled Jake to the ground. As time went on, the well-meaning assaults became more violent. Jake began to avoid Saeed, sending students to the stationery office on his behalf, unwilling to risk serious injury. But perhaps the loudest, most strident person at Smoker's Corner was Rashida, the Lebanese algebra teacher. Rashida used the 5-minute break between lessons to smoke half a cigarette, hide the other half in a groove in the wall, and then hurry back to her class. During her free periods, she would often fall asleep in Smoker's Corner, and we tried in vain to conduct conversations over the noise of her steady snoring. She was not popular for many reasons, the main one being her miserliness, which was legendary.
"I have forgot my cigarettes,"
she would whine, looking imploringly at the smokers until somebody gave her one, usually Colton. I could see into her bag and knew she was not telling the truth. Saeed needed to collect 50 fils, about 85p or $1, from each of us as a deposit for our keys.
"You will not want 50 fils from little me,"
wheedled Rashida, wearing a most winning smile.
"Everybody must get 50 fils,"
Joe helpfully suggested.
"No.
Give you 50 fils," I tried.
"No, everybody must go to the auditorium for a meeting with Mr. Rina after school. Rashida, please give me 50 fils."
Rashida nipped off the end of her cigarette, surreptitiously hid it in the wall, and marched away, a determined look on her face. I happened to be there with Saeed when she returned later in the afternoon.
"Here, I have for you the 50 fils,"
she said, and dropped a handful of coins into his outstretched palm.
Thank
you," I suggested.
"No, that's a miracle," he said,
and even Rashida smiled. Rashida smoked her half-cigarette and strode away, to be replaced by Joe and Colton.
"That Rashida,"
complained Colton.
"She's just asked me if I can spare some small change for a phone call."
"That's strange. She asked me, too."
"And me,"
said Essam. It seemed that everybody had contributed toward Rashida's key deposit, except Rashida. Rashida was in her late 50s and had left her husband back in Lebanon, attracted by better wages in Bahrain. She called him daily, and her booming voice, like the prayer chants, halted all conversation in Smoker's Corner.
"Hey, were you having a fight?"
Colton asked when she concluded a particularly loud and aggressive-sounding call. Rashida frowned.
"No,"
she said, shaking her head.
"I just suggest to my husband what he make for his dinner today."
Rashida was mannish and rather unkempt. She wore her hair scraped back, and her makeup must have been applied in the dark with a spade. Her English was quite good.